Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. My name's Mike Fenton-Stevens, and My Time Capsule is the podcast where I ask my guests to tell me the five things from their life that they would like to have in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish and one thing that they'd like to forget, something they want to bury in the ground and never think of again. My guest in this episode is the ex-stand-up comedian, ex-presenter, ex-award-winning radio DJ and talk show host, ex-breakfast TV host, ex-I'm a Celebrity Get Me Out of Here contestant, ex-record label owner. Look, let's face it, Ian Lee has done most things. His TV career started on the 11 o'clock show on Channel 4, which was the starting point for comedians such as Ricky Gervais and Sacha Baron Cohen. He moved in 2002 to become the co-host of Channel 4's live breakfast show, Rise, which unfortunately only lasted about a year. He went on to present Thumb Bandits, a video game show, and Liquid News, and was in Celebrity Soup, Law of the Playground, My Worst Week, How Do They Do It?, The One Show, Sky News, and he made regular appearances on This Morning and Big Brother's companion series, Bit on the Psych and Big Brother's Little Brother. He actually came third in the 2017 series of I'm a Celebrity, which is not bad. His extensive radio work includes shows on XFM, LBC, Absolute Radio, where he hosted the Sunday night show, and then the Monday to Thursday evening slot. He won a Radio Academy Award in 2014 for Breakfast Show of the Year, moved to Talk Radio in 2016, winning the Audio and Radio Industry Award for Best Speech Presenter. Personally, I prefer my DJs to use Semaphore. And he won that award again in 2020, this time for Moment of the Year, for directing emergency services to a caller who had taken an overdose, which he talks about in more detail in this podcast. In July 2020, Ian announced that he'd been signed by Twitch to continue hosting the Late Night Alternative on its streaming platform. The show allows video calls from viewers worldwide. In 2023, Ian announced his retirement from radio in order to focus more on his work as a counsellor. So there you are. There are some things that Wikipedia will tell you about Ian Lee. But what does he think are the important things in his life? Well, let's find out, shall we? Here is the delightful Ian Lee, and a bit of me. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did.
How are you? What have you been up to?
I've retired from show business. I don't know if you've heard.
Yeah, that was the rumour.
And I feel fantastic. 30 years of chasing. Mm. And, you know, the circle gradually getting smaller and smaller. And the last job I did on this little breakfast show in Oxford, I hated it. Didn't like it. There was stuff going on, you know, stuff was going on there. There's always stuff going on. And I just thought, I'm not enjoying this. I wonder what would happen if I stopped. And in the meantime, I'd retrained as a counsellor. And so I have a plan B for the first time ever in my life. I have a plan B.
So what led you down that route, though? What made you think, do you know what? That's something I'd be interested in doing, being a counsellor.
I can tell you the moment that it kind of clicked was about 4 years ago. We had a guy phone up the radio show, and I was doing a late night radio show, and he'd taken an overdose. And he didn't know where he was. He was outside somewhere and he didn't know where he was. So I kept him on air for 30 minutes. And the reason I kept him on air was because I was getting him to describe what he could see. We knew he was in Plymouth. And then he was describing, I can see this, I can see this, I can see this. And someone phoned up and said, oh, I think I know where he is. I think he's here. So then my producer phoned emergency services. And I was talking to him for half an hour just to, you know, keep him. And he disappeared for 7 minutes. He stopped talking. I thought, oh, shoot, man, this guy's dead.
Yeah.
And I kept talking and kept talking. And he came back. Eventually, the police picked up the phone. We've got him. We'll deal with this now. And he went to intensive care. He lived, but he did die. And they brought him back to life. So it was serious. This was a real close call. And, you know, I didn't know what to say. So we're doing all the supportive stuff. And after 15 minutes, I have nothing left. So I said, right, what's your favorite Die Hard movie? I'm asking him about Die Hard when he's dying. And I thought, this is not good. So I came away from that, Michael, thinking, I wonder what I could have done differently if I'd have known what I was doing. If I had some skills, apart from life skills, if I had some actual skills in my tool belt, I wonder what I could have done differently. So that was the point where I started considering it. And then I lost a job just into lockdown. I lost that radio gig and there was nothing on the horizon and the timing was right to sign up for a diploma. You know, it all fell into place.
Yeah.
The universe gave me that opportunity.
Well, it's a nice opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very easy and probably correct to look at all the things that you and I have done in our lives and go, well, what was the fucking point of that?
Do you think that? Because I am thinking that at the moment. Not about your career, Michael, I wouldn't be so bold. But about my career, there are very, you know, 25, 30 years, there are very few things that I'm really proud of. You know, very few things I can go, that's dear to my heart. Maybe I could maybe think of three or four I'm proud of in terms of the work.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say, oh, no, but you did this and this. But it doesn't register with me. It doesn't connect.
No, I don't really think about the work after I've done it.
Yeah.
I like doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, so really, I'm sort of chasing self-satisfaction. I sort of find it enjoyable to do.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I'm just fulfilling my wish to be indulged.
Well, and I understand that. What's interesting is, you know, now I'm a counsellor and I've got clients and I'm private practice and it's not completely altruistic. One, I'm being paid. So there's a financial side. But two, I really, really enjoy it. I get pleasure out of it. So I'm not just doing it for the person sat opposite me. I'm getting pleasure out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, some people find it a little bit weird in terms of, you know, that. But actually, no, I think it's a human thing.
Almost as if you ought to be some sort of, you know, saintly Mother Teresa type thing. Yeah. I do nothing for myself. I just give.
I'm suffering. I'm feeling their pain. And, you know, it's very, very early days. I am finding it so satisfying. And of course, you know, if someone came with a really good offer, you know, and the money was right and it fitted in, you know, of course I'd do it. Of course I'd do another show. Or
yeah, I mean, in fact, you may even find then, having found this other side of your life, that the job then is really good because you go, well, actually, this is unimportant. This is just a sort of piece of flimsy that I do.
Do you know what? I got that. I remember the moment I got that none of this TV stuff matters and radio stuff matters. I was doing a breakfast TV show, not The Big Breakfast. It was what came after it, Rise, that flopped miserably because people wanted The Big Breakfast. Mm. And I couldn't get it. I'd never done a live TV show, 2-hour live TV show, and I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it. And then 3 months in, I thought, oh, this isn't important. The only one that thinks it's important is me. This is fluff. And if I do a bad show, it doesn't matter because I'm doing another show tomorrow. And once I got, you know, and it was that thing, we're all going to die and no one's going to remember, you know, once I got that thing, this is not important. Show business is not important.
Yeah.
It suddenly becomes so much easier, doesn't it?
It does. I think it really does because actually the longevity of it makes that clear, I think, is that for some people, these things are important and they like that sort of trivia in a way. They like looking back at detail and that's fine. Have fun. But I get sent photographs. Oh, look, I've just found this image of you doing Home James. What? And I go, oh, with Jim Davidson. Oh, God.
Home James.
Do you know, and I've absolutely forgotten that I did it.
Yeah. And isn't that interesting? Because I remember Home James and it was huge. But with no disrespect to you, most people won't remember that.
No.
You know, it's gone. But it's really hitting me recently. When I'm on my deathbed, I will not be saying, I wish I'd done more radio shows. I wish I'd pushed harder to get that script picked up. It'll be, I wish I spent more time with my kids. I wish I'd had more holidays. I wish I'd, you know, yeah. had sex more. I wish I'd done all of this living stuff more, which is, we forget to
I
do.
Know. I can't have more sex, surely.
Jesus, how much are you doing?
I'm doing it at the moment.
You're going to be a husk. Shooting sand.
I think I'm doing it. Am I doing it wrong?
Well, thank God I can't see what's going on downstairs. I'm not a sex therapist. I cannot help you with that.
No, okay.
Can I ask you one question before we start? And then if the answer is yes, it will become clear in the thing. And if the answer is no, it won't become clear. I'll explain. Did you ever work on Simon Mayo's TV show, Confessions?
I did, yeah.
We'll talk about that in the thing then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
No, it's nothing bad. Don't worry. It's nothing bad. No. It's not a
stunt. I don't mind either way. Okay. As we've pointed out, this is insignificant.
There we go. Beautiful. Very zen. Yeah. Right. I'll shut up. You do what you need
no,
to do.
There's no start. There's no shut up. We just sort of segue beautifully into you telling me about the five things from your life you put in a time capsule, which you may have already started. I don't know.
No, I haven't. But okay, well, in that case, very quickly, I will just, let me just move that there because there's my list. I did a list. We have met before, and I do not expect you to remember it. There's no reason you would remember it at all because this was before I was on TV. I asked you if you'd worked on Simon Mayo's Confessions.
Right.
And the reason I asked that is because my sister worked on it. Jo Rugby, she would have been at the time. Mm-hmm. And she was I think she was a runner. I'm not quite sure. She was doing something, you know, one of the people that are often overlooked but actually is integral.
Mm-hmm.
And me and my friend Simon, we were budding actors and performers. And she said, do you want to come and see how the show's made and what's going on? I said, yeah, sure, that'd be great. I think it was at LWT, the London studios, I think.
It was, yes.
Yeah. And so we came in and we got to sit in the office, you know, and there's Simon Mayo over in the corner and there's this, and there's the director. And we were sat at a table and directly opposite was you. Because I'm assuming you were a writer on it?
No, I did the voiceover.
Oh, okay. You were there, and me and my friend Simon, we were both a little bit, oh my God, it's Michael Vincent Stevens. Oh my God, this is...
Oh dear.
We were trying to play it cool. And then I said something that made you laugh, right? That sense of pride, and I made you laugh. And I'll never forget, this is the most ridiculous line, but it's a line that keeps coming back to me. My friend Simon said, oh look, you made the laughter make a laugh. And that... That must have been 96, I think, 97, yeah. I'm not sure.
Something
and
that
line
yeah.
has always stuck with me. Me saying something funny, no idea what it was. You giggling or chuckling, Riley, and Simon saying...
Made the laughter make a laugh.
You made the laughter make a laugh.
Well, how lovely to be a laughter maker.
Well, you are, and you know. I nearly said you were. What a terrible thing.
It may be true.
I met is a strong word, but we sat opposite each other. It was before I was on telly, before, you know, I was still... Probably still at college, I think.
Well, thank God I wasn't a bastard then. Thank God. I nearly said cunt then.
you can't say cunt, Michael, please.
You can't say cunt on here.
Imagine if the only reason I said yes to this was because 25 years ago you were a bastard to me.
Yeah, I wanted to get back at you.
For it.
You're going to sit here and say, right, go on, ask me five things. Right, this, and this, and this. Now fill your fucking program yourself, you bastard.
No, yeah. you were delightful.
Do you know what I'd like to bury in a time capsule? You, mate. You.
I'm going to give you my first of my five things.
That'd be marvellous.
I thought this was going to be difficult, but actually, these came quite easily. They were quite specific, and I broadened them out slightly. And are we allowed to bring, like, heavy stuff into this time capsule? We are, aren't we?
Anything you want, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to make you laugh, hopefully, again. Make the laughter make a laugh. And who knows, dear listener, I might make you cry at some point. Mm-hmm. My first thing in the time capsule, and you'll be able to identify with this, was the first time proper I was on television. I'd done some stuff. Do you remember Live TV, the TV channel at the top of Canary Wharf with topless darts and things? It was awful. And I'd done some bits on there, but that doesn't count.
So I loved topless darts.
You loved it, did you, dirty bastard?
I'm going to, just for a moment, before you get into this story, I'm going to interrupt you with the fact that when we did KYTV...
Oh, God, I love
the
that.
The sports channel for KYTV... We said, coming this Saturday, topless darts. And we just had a lot of fat people with their shirts on.
So they nicked the idea from you.
We still think that somebody looked at that and went, do you know what? Actually, that could work.
Yeah, they stole the idea from me. KYTV, is that... It's not on DVD, is it? Is it available to stream anywhere?
I think it's only on YouTube.
Right, yeah. Okay. It's another one of those things. I remember for years and years and years, the goodies weren't available to watch, and Bill Oddie was furious about this, you know. And things like KYTV, we talked earlier about... Actually, it may seem insignificant to you, I don't know, but that was one of the key things in me developing, in me learning what I thought was funny, in me learning in learning humour and timing and what was funny and what wasn't funny, and your show wasn't funny, and that, I'm joking. So that was integral. When was the... Well, let me flip this. This is the problem of having someone on who interviews people. I'm going to flip it. What was your first time on TV?
Not the 9 o'clock news.
Was it really?
Yeah, isn't that weird?
What a show to be on. What a show. And do you remember the first gag or the first sketch that got broadcast?
Yeah. I can't actually remember what the sketch was, but I know that it was set on an aeroplane and I was sitting next to Griff.
Wow.
And bizarrely, I was knitting. I was knitting at the time. I'd learned to knit. And I said, shall I knit? And they went, yeah, okay.
Don't say that when I've just taken a mouthful of coffee, please. New trousers.
I've no idea. I was still a student. I was brought down to London by John Lloyd.
Thrilling? Was it thrilling? I mean, we talked about how we don't really remember some of the stuff, so this may be a hazy mist to you.
I can't remember if it was thrilling, actually. I think that I just felt, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do, right. You know. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I was in it. And I had no idea of the rules at all. So yeah. I just followed John Lloyd around, who was producing it. They'd already done a series. And I just followed John around. And I remember sitting with him and Sean Hardy writing jokes.
Incredible.
He said, come and join us. Yeah. Got any ideas for the news links? And I said, don't know. And I just started writing jokes. Do you know, I don't think I'd ever written a joke in my life at that point.
Really? That was it? Mm. You were suddenly with two, you know, great people to be working on. Any gags?
Yeah.
How about this?
I know. And actually, it turns out that I could write jokes. I went, what about that? And they went, oh, it's quite funny, yeah. Anyway.
Writing is a dark art to me. I can't write gags. Can't really tell gags. And the stuff I've done is often not gag-based, particularly not in the last 15 years on the radio. Mm. I cannot write gags. And to me, it's like someone writing a symphony or, you know, doing some dark art incantation. Don't get it. You know, it's incredible to see it.
Yeah.
Going back, so the first time proper on TV was the 11 o'clock show.
Really?
It was. And it had been a huge build up to it. Because I studied performing arts, mm-hmm. Middlesex University, the year after it became a university, before it was a polytechnic.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be an actor. That was the thing I really wanted to do, to be an actor. There was a wonderful tutor there, a guy called Hugh Thomas, who taught a module on stand up comedy. Now, you can't be taught how to be funny. It was more about the mechanics of what stand-up could be. And he basically said, it can be anything you want. You know, you learn some microphone technique. You can do anything. Mm. So I ended up after college. I couldn't get any acting work. So I was doing stand-up. And that led to me getting a small little slot on a breakfast show on a radio station in Milton Keynes. I was Ian in Black Thunder. And I had to drive around Milton Keynes getting people to do stuff. And I hated it. Really hated it. It just didn't click for me. So after 6 months, I quit. On the week that I quit, one of the team came in and said, oh, we've had a fax, Ian. You might be interested in this. And it was Channel 4... or maybe Talkback Productions are looking to create a new nightly topical comedy show, We Will See Anybody, is basically what it said. We Will See Anybody. And I thought, all right, I'm going to have some of this. I had an agent at the time, and I said, put me forward for this. He said, no, I don't think you're right for it. I said, I really want to go for this. He said, I don't think you're right for it. So I put myself forward for it. And this was my last roll of the dice, because I was out of college, had no money, was back living with my mum. I must have been 24 or 25. And this was the last roll of the dice before I went and got a proper job. And I went for the audition, and the audition was me filming a little Vox Pop thing and doing a little silly news thing that I had written. So it was a bit clunky. And I kept getting called back. And I was called back. You will have been good friends with this guy, by Harry Thompson. Mm. The wonderful Harry Thompson, whose fingers, you know, were all over comedy and still has an influence, even though he's no longer with us, still has a huge influence on how comedy TV is made and edited and stuff. And he kept calling me back and calling me back. And in the end, he said, I really want you on this show. Would you do it? Yes, I'll do it. And originally I was, yeah, you've got to say no to him. And originally, although I wish I had said no a few times, particularly when he made me do They Think It's All Over, which was bloody hideous. Hated that. Anyway, so I was just going to be this guy that did the Vox Pops on the street. And they auditioned everyone, comedians, radio presenters, writers, to be one of the three main presenters. Mm. And the week before it went out, it was going to go out Tuesday, Wednesdays, Thursdays. And the week before, they had Brendan Burns and they had Fred McCauley. They were locked in. Mm. But they didn't have the third. And they kept trying people and kept trying people. And I have no idea where this confidence came from. I went up to Harry and said, I can do that. I'd never done it before. I went, I can do that. And he went, and this is why he was so great. He went, you know what? We'll take a punt. Let's do a pilot with you.
Wow.
This was on the Thursday, the week before it started on the Tuesday. And after he said, you were brilliant, you're in. So suddenly I'm hosting a TV show on Channel 4 with Fred and Brendan. And I'll shut up in a minute because I want to hear your voice more than mine. No. The premise of it was all filmed on the day. Mm. The premise was slightly not quite true, but it would be written on the day and filmed on the day. So I went out and recorded a Vox Pop. I came back in the afternoon. All the gags were written. I sat down there and I read an auto cue. Brilliant. Thrilling. The real thrill was going home with my then girlfriend, Tessa, to her house because I was still living at mum's. And we got a bottle of wine and we sat and watched it. Oh my God, I can feel it now. The excitement, the pride, the thrill. It wasn't quite what I wanted to do. It wasn't acting, but I was on telly hosting a TV show, the third wheel in a TV show. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I feel it now. I feel the excitement now. Nothing like it.
No, I bet.
Nothing like it.
I bet. I mean, and it was a brilliant show. It was exactly what everybody had been trying to do for a long time.
Yeah.
I did a nightly live show, but sadly we did it for BSB, before it became BSkyB, with the Squareal.
The Squareal. Let's just take a moment. Mm, Squareal. Kids, the you've Squareal. Got no idea with your high-speed broadband. We had Squareals.
Slightly classier than those round ones. Mm. Yeah.
It was supposed to be, wasn't it? What was the show you did?
I think it was called Up Your News, okay. Which is, I think that's what it was called.
Yeah.
But it had good people, Caroline Quentin and Paul Merton did a few. And
wow,
some,
brilliant.
You know, some good actors. And we had a guest host each time. So for us, it was a joy because it meant we had sort of people like Spike Milligan turned up and did a night, you know. And Kenneth Connor, I remember.
I'm going to write this down because I want to, I've not heard of this. I want to look this up later on. Up Your News. Okay.
Yeah, I wonder. I've never seen it.
That writing that stuff in a day is tough.
Mm.
That is tough.
The whole thing done in a day. Yeah, it was fun.
Incredible. And that's what the 11 o'clock show was. And it was the springboard. People forget some of the people that worked on that in front of the camera, behind the camera. Jimmy Carr was the warm-up man.
Right.
Jimmy Carr and Robin Ince were the warm-up men. You know, imagine having Jimmy wasn't on the show. I don't know if he ever appeared on the show. Jimmy Carr. Whatever happened to him? I don't know.
Don't know.
Where he went. Jimmy Carr, Robin Ince, Ricky Gervais, his first TV show, Mackenzie Crook, who I was living with at the time. Me and Mackenzie were flatmates, and I would kind of help get him in. Donovan, Dan Mazer, who was a producer and went and produced loads of TV series, and I think a couple of films in America. Who else?
Ali G.
Of course, Sasha, Ali G, you know, who was the star of the show. You know, he became a phenomenon. You know, he was everywhere. You know, Richard Madeley doing an impression of him on This Morning. He really seeped into the zeitgeist. And it's hard to imagine that now, looking back. He was massive, absolutely massive. But what a joy. 25-year-old, naive, scared me being surrounded by all of these incredible talents who went on to take over show business.
Yeah.
What a thrill.
Mm. I mean, Ricky, that's the first time he sort of did the Office character, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sort of, although it was angrier.
Oh, it was horrendous. You know, and I loved it. It was delicious. And Ricky was everyone loved Ali G. Ricky divided people straight down the middle. I remember a discussion in the 11 o'clock show office because he was almost the second presenter along with me. When it got down to two presenters, me and Daisy, he was almost Daisy Donovan.
Wow.
Which is a strange phrase to say. and I remember in the 11 o'clock show office with a couple of the commissioning editors, and we were watching a video that Ricky had done, and the producer, Dom English, who took over from Harry, turned and said, right, Is that funny? half the room went, that is the funniest thing we've ever, tears. The other half went, I don't get it. I'm not sure what he's doing. And it was, it really was that close. And it was the same with the audience. Some people loved it. Some people hate it. I mean, he was obnoxious. His character, he himself was a lovely, wonderful human being. He was very generous to me at the time. But, you know, I would be sat opposite him doing a skit. And I just, honestly, you could tell he was destined for great things. Being that close to a master of comedy. Whatever you think about him now, but he was he is a master of comedy. And sitting opposite that, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine, you know, similar to you sitting on a writing table with John Lloyd, you know, another master of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You just feel that energy coming from them, that electricity zapping out of them.
Yeah, yeah. It's really obvious, isn't it, when you see them. The first Edinburgh Festival I did as a student, we shared a dressing room with the Cambridge Footlights. And in that Footlights team were Hugh Laurie, Stephen Fry, and Emma Thompson.
Oh, incredible.
Now, I mean,
incredible.
We knew that Hugh and Stephen were funny, but Emma Thompson, to see her on stage in front of an audience, even at that young age, it was so obvious.
Yeah.
You thought, God, she's going to be enormously famous.
People, I think, sometimes forget because of some of her movies. She's hilarious.
Mm.
And, you know, I imagine back then as well, there's still sometimes. Do you remember that thing, women aren't funny? Do you remember that? That was a real, name a woman that makes me, well, there's loads of them. But I would imagine back then, what was this, early 80s, late 70s? Or when would that have been?
That's when she did her own television series.
She did, yeah.
Thompson.
Yeah.
And it was, it was attacked from every angle.
Yeah.
It had some very funny stuff in it.
Yeah.
But it, right from the start, it had that attitude of, but she's just a woman on her own. How can that be funny?
Exactly. Speaking of women on their own, you also worked on the Kate Robbins show.
I did, yeah.
I know Kate a bit, you know, and she is so delightful. When she was in Crossroads, she was a very, very important woman in my life as a young man, because she was, she still is hot. I'm going to say it. Kate Robbins, you're hot. And another woman who, you know, getting your place. You are not meant to be funny. You're meant to be the support for the funny man.
Yeah.
And she is so talented as well, and so funny. The voices and the characters and the sing. She does everything.
But I love the fact that she's now been discovered as an actress.
Yes.
That actually she's suddenly doing all sorts of serious stuff. And Ricky, in a way, led to that, putting her in Afterlife.
That's true, actually, yeah.
People went, oh, my God, yeah, Kate's good, isn't she?
Yeah.
And I think that she's having a real resurgence.
Yeah, and I think you're right. There is. You have to ride the wave. If you're lucky, you have a period where you're really successful, everyone loves you and everyone knows your name. There are exceptions, but there is almost inevitably that downswing where, you know, you're out of fashion, you're not so hot. I don't mean in terms of looks, but I mean in terms of being wanted by TV companies.
Yeah.
And some people, when that wave dips, they go, oh, you know what? I'm done. I'm out. And Kate is brilliant because she rode that wave and she came back up, and she, and naturally funny as well.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, she hardly recognizes it in herself. It's weird.
Really?
The number of conversations I've had with Kate where I've said, you are just one of the funniest women. She said, oh, no, I'm not. No, I'm really boring.
Wow. Isn't that funny how we see ourselves?
And going back to Confessions, Ted Robbins was the warm-up for Confessions.
Yeah. You know, what a family, you know, because they're cousins, obviously, of the McCartneys. You know, I'm a big fan of Mike and Paul, since they couldn't remember his name for a second.
Mike and Dee's brother.
Mike. Yeah. I am lucky enough to, I know Mike a little bit. And he always talks about our kid. So our kids was, you know, I think that's so lovely. I asked him once, I was interviewing Mike. I said, Mike, can I ask you a question? He said, you can ask me anything. So what's Paul McCartney's phone number? And he rattled off the phone number from when they were like 10 years old. And I thought, that is, what a great answer to a dumb question. And how wonderful that you remember that.
Yeah.
Because I've not yet been, but I want to go to McCartney's and Lennon's houses, you know, the National Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike pretty much made the McCartney's house look like it did in the late 50s. You know, he was the one that went, right, well, this was the wallpaper, this was the carpet, these are the photos that we had hanging up. You know, he's such a talent as well. What a family.
Amazing lot. Yeah, Kate told me that he turned up for McCartney when her mum was in hospital and they knew she didn't have long to live. And he turned up and the doctor came in to see her and then pointed to Kate and said, come outside. And she went outside and thought, oh, God, what's he going to say? And he said, sorry, is that Paul McCartney? She went, yeah. He went, "That's one of my favourite songs." And Paul McCartney was sitting by the side of her bed singing Blackbird to her.
Oh, my God. What a moment.
Isn't that amazing?
What a moment. How beautiful.
It really is. I mean, I think for all the fame and for all being a Beatle, that says more about that man than anything. I think it's a beautiful story.
What a beautiful story. Yeah, that is that's lovely.
Yeah. So the 11 o'clock show, well, I could talk to you about it for ages because I love it. But which man in the world didn't fall in love with Daisy?
Yep, she was beautiful, hilarious, really, really smart. Again, you know, just absolutely spot on. She was so good. She was so good.
Fantastic. I mean, she's wonderful, I think.
Yeah.
And it was a great programme. It was a programme that for so many years people have been talking about making that programme. Yeah. And that was the first time that it really succeeded and maybe the only time. It was great.
There's been a few attempts. The thing with that was lightning in a bottle. Mm. It was a time when Channel 4 has toned down a bit, possibly for the better. You know, there was a lot of meanness in the 11 o'clock show. But what are the odds of collecting all of that unknown talent and them all turning out to go to America and make movies, to have sitcoms, to host game shows and be so successful? Mm. That's very, very unlikely to happen again, I would suggest.
But I'm going to put that thrill of... I think you sitting with a bottle of wine watching the show, the thrill of that.
Yeah.
If ever I watch anything that I'm in, I don't get that thrill.
I don't watch anything now. I don't watch it. I don't want to see it. I've done that. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I watched a tiny bit of I'm a Celebrity back, but I'd have no interest in seeing or listening to what I do. At that point, I did watch every show because I wanted to learn.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go, right, what did I do right? Why did that gag not work? That was good. I'm going to do that again. Mm. So I did used to watch it then as a learning tool, and it was nice for the ego. But no, now I have no interest in seeing me. I live with me and I get on my nerves all the time. I don't want to see me.
Quite. And as time goes by, you just look and go, gee, what the fuck has happened to me? I don't look like that. Who is that old bloke?
What was it? I did something a while ago and then there was like a shot and it was on a big screen. And I said, why have you got a picture of my dad up there? What's going on?
Yep,
getting older.
Oh, well, all right. Well, let's put that in as the first thing then.
Okay, thank you.
Fantastic. Okay, good. Let's move on to number two.
I keep looking to my left because I've got my things typed on the screen, and I've just realised I've got five good things. I'm thinking, right, well, which one do I kick out? Mm-hmm. So I tell you what I'm going to put in. I'm going to put in the made-for-television pop group The Monkees. I adore The Monkees. When I was about... 4 or 5, so that would have been about 78, 79, my parents gave me a dance set record player. Oh, my God, I loved it. And they gave me 4 records. One of them was the William Tell Overture. Thanks, guys. One of them was... I'm embarrassed to say it. One of them was the Black and White Minstrels. Mm-hmm. To a 4 or 5-year-old. Wow. The other two... One was the Monkees' first album and their single, I'm a Believer, back with I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. And as a kid, I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed. Something was going on. Then a few years later, they repeated the TV show during the school holidays. And I just, something clicked and it became an obsession. And this obsession has gone on, oh my God, 45 years, you know, I'm 50 this year. And it was an obsession. You know, when I got to about 13, 14, I remember all I had was this album and this single. And when I was about 13, I've got to buy a greatest hits. I've got to go out and buy a record. And I didn't have enough money. I went to Our Price Records in Slough, in the Queensbury Shopping Centre. And I went in and I was about £2 short. And I was like, oh, God. So I went to the fountain. There was a fountain outside where people would chuck coins in. Remember, it was freezing cold. It was November. It was so cold. I took the coins out of the fountain. So some poor charity has suffered about 2 or 3 quid. And I took these coins out and I went to the shop and I bought this record. And it was, you know, people talk about the first time they saw Bowie on TV and they go, oh, it was life-changing because you didn't know if he was a boy or a girl. You didn't, you know, and it just, he was a freak like me. This album was my David Bowie. I took it home and every song was better than the last. I thought, wow, how is this happening? How is this happening? This is incredible. And I was really lucky because that moment was around the time the Monkees got back together. 3 of them got back together, 86. So they were a real thing again, really, in inverted commas. They were a touring act, and I was able to, you know, get information about what they were doing and the fact that they were touring, and I would buy these horrible bootleg videos that were terrible quality. And then they came over to the UK in 1987. Me and my friend Michael went at the Royal Albert Hall. Oh, my God, I felt alive. I felt absolutely alive. It was wonderful to see these heroes.
Oh, I bet it was, yeah.
Well, I was going to say old men. They would have been about 38, 39 at the time. You know, babies.
Yeah.
And that obsession grew and grew and grew. And I was very lucky with my friend Glenn. A few years ago, we set up a record label. I'm not to do with it now. It's Glenn. But we set up this record label solely to put out obscure Monkees records, solo records and stuff like that. And I ended up working with three of them.
No.
No, ended up working with two of them, but being friends with the family of Davey as well. And I ended up working with Mike Nesmith and Mickey Dolenz, and we would email each other, and I had Mickey's phone number, and I went out for lunch with him last year when he came over. And, you know, I can call Mickey Dolenz a friend.
Brilliant.
This is amazing. And 13-year-old me, who's still inside, you know, I was having lunch with him. I'm thinking, oh, my God, there's Mickey Dolenz over there. Don't stare at him. They have brought me so much pleasure. I took my eldest son when he would have been six to a Monkees concert, his first ever concert, Hammersmith Odeon. We were sat at the front and he was loving it. And then there's a bit in the show during a song called Going Down where Dolenz would go and get an audience member to sing a verse. And he's walking across and he looked at me and recognized me and he went, do you want to do it? I went, yes, I do. So I got up and I'm singing Going Down. We're looking at Mickey Dolenz, locking eyes, and I handed the microphone back and a big, big cheer. Whoa. And I turned around and my six-year-old at the time, he's 13 now, Alex, was sat there with his legs scrunched up like this, hands over his eyes, and he wouldn't look at me.
No, my dad.
Yeah, and
oh,
I said, how are you feeling? He said, I can't put it into words, but my stomach is whizzing around and my head hurts. I went, son, that's embarrassment. That's my job. There's going to be plenty more where that comes from.
Yeah. Oh, how brilliant.
Yeah.
What a thing, though.
Yeah.
What did you call the record label?
The record label's 7A Records, because there's a lovely bit at the beginning of Daydream Believer where the producer goes, 7A. And Davey says, what number is this? And they all go, 7A. He goes, all right, just because I'm short, I know. So we called it 7A, and it was a successful thing. You know, we weren't lighting cigars with £50 notes, but we brought a lot of pleasure to people. You know, it's very, very niche. I think our biggest record may have sold 1,000. They tended to sell 300-400. But what an impact. And it was stuff, really obscure stuff that would never get released, and people loved it. You know, it brought a lot of pleasure.
Well, it's interesting with the music of the Monkees, isn't it? Because that first album would have almost entirely been written by extremely famous songwriters from the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Neil Diamond wasn't. He was on the second, but Carole King was on there.
Carole King.
Who was on there?
Carole Mayer Sager?
I don't know if she was on that one. I think she might have been on the second. David Gates from Brent. It was great. And, of course, the controversy was, well, they're not a real band. Well, they're not a real band. They don't play on their albums. Well, they didn't play on their first two. They played on the later ones. Who cares?
Yeah, and actually some of those later ones are the songs that they wrote for themselves.
Yeah.
Were really interesting.
Yeah.
And they showed that, you know, they'd been set up as the American Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
And they showed that actually they, to a large extent, had the same sort of innovative skills.
They were, yeah, you know, they were, the Beatles are the Beatles, the greatest rock and roll band in the world. You'll never come close. But yeah, Mike Nesmith, I believe, invented country rock. That the Eagles, you know, the Eagles went on to do, and the Birds went on to do. And Dolenz wrote this great song called Randy Scouse Git, right? And he got the name because he watched this. It would have been Till Death Us Do Part, or you know, the Alf Garnett thing, whatever the name of it was at that point. And during that show, Alf Garnett would call his son-in-law a Randy Scouse Git. And that phrase meant nothing to Dolenz. He wrote, well, I'm nicking that, and that's going to be the title of my song. And the record label went, nah, you cannot have a song called Randy Scouse Git. You need an alternate title. So he said, we'll call it that, alternate title. And people don't realize that was a bigger hit than Daydream Believer. That went to number two. Daydream Believer, I think, went to number four or five. I'm so full of boring stats.
No, it's crazy, though, isn't it?
And that whole thing of, well, they're not a real band, who cares? Who cares? Yeah. You know, it's music. Is the music good?
Well, they weren't to you as well, weren't they?
Yeah.
I wish my friend Jeremy Pascal was still alive. He was a DJ with Capital Radio for quite a long time.
Okay.
But when he was a young man, he worked for the NME.
Yeah.
And was given the option of interviewing the Beatles or the monkeys.
Oh.
And he forever after was known as Jeremy the Monkeys Pascal because he picked the monkeys.
How fantastic. He made the right choice, I believe.
Well, maybe he did. You know, lots of people interviewed the Beatles, but yeah, he got to talk to them, the monkeys, right at the start.
Can I just say, by the way, dear listener, you don't know what I'm going to talk about, do you?
No.
And how wonderful that you're able to reference your friend and have a story that's connected to this. That's the thing I've noticed. I've heard the podcast a couple of times. You have a story for everything that's thrown at you.
Let's hope I'm not making him up. That's all. Well, I'm going to ask an important question. I know this is a difficult one to answer.
Yeah.
But who was your favourite?
It fluctuates. I'm going to say Michael Nesmith. I'm going to say him. And I'll tell you why, because he didn't do the reunions, for the early reunions. He did, and I was lucky enough, I flew over to the States to go and see when it was Peter and Mickey and Mike. Ooh. And I got an interview with Mike when he wasn't doing interviews. I was so lucky. I just emailed him. He went, yeah, sure. When do you want to do it? Oh, my God. And he's the most excited I've ever been about an interview. And I said, look, Mike, I know you don't like talking about the monkeys. He said, Ian, you can ask me anything you want about the monkeys. I said, all right, Mike. So when you're recording, I don't want to talk about the monkeys. I'm only joking. You can ask me. And for about 3 minutes, every time I ask the question, Ian, I do not want to talk about the monkeys. I'm joking. Go on. You ask me anything you want. And that was a real thrill because at the time I got my first interview, he wasn't doing interviews and I got him. And, you know, it was, you know, you must have worked with people who you look up to. I don't know if you'd call them heroes, but people you respect and admire and a big fan of. And it's a real thrill, isn't it? When your career allows you to work with someone who you have a deep respect and love for.
Absolutely, especially when they then talk to you as if you're the same as them.
That's
you go, what? Yeah. What? That's ridiculous. Yeah. And strangely enough, this is, you're going to think I must have known what you were going to say.
Yeah.
But I got a phone call one Sunday afternoon from a friend of mine who was the floor manager on the Little and Large show.
Okay.
And they said, can you play the bass guitar? And I said, a bit. They said, can you play it enough to look as if you're playing it if you mime? And I said, yeah. They said, oh, do you know Daydream Believer? And I said, I do, yeah. So he said, get up to the BBC studios as soon as you can. So I drove to the BBC.
Yeah.
And they said, right, this is Davy Jones. You're going to be the bass player behind him, but you have to sing the harmony for Daydream Believer with
him. This is amazing.
So I sang Daydream Believer with Davy Jones on the Little and Large show.
This is amazing. And this is, honestly, it really does sound like we've planned this. I used to run a YouTube channel called Rare Monkeys, and it's still up there. I've lost the login, so I can't get in. That clip is on that channel.
Well, I'm there, yeah.
I'm checking that out straight after. That is hilarious. That is absolutely hilarious and wonderful. Oh, I'm going to have a look at that later. I've seen that clip a dozen times and I never noticed. How funny.
Why would you?
Yeah.
You look at them. Why would you look at a bloke playing the bass?
How funny. I was lucky enough. I got Eddie Large became a friend. We did. You remember in 2016, everyone died. David Bowie, Prince, George Michael, everyone died. Yeah. And there are all these tributes. Oh, weren't they great? And me and my producer, Catherine, kept thinking, we should have said this to these people before they died. We've got this wrong. So we did a thing where we would get, you know, kind of older comedians or older people that had meant something to us to come on the show. We'd invite them on. We had Paul Daniels and we had David Hamilton and Tommy Cannon and we had Eddie Large. And some of them were waiting for the punch because they knew me from the 11 o'clock show and that's kind of sarcastic. And some of them were really waiting for the sucker punch and it didn't come. It was all affection. And I became friends with Eddie Large and he hadn't done a show for ages. He'd lost his bottle. He'd lost his nerve. And I kept saying to him, how about if I put on a Q&A show where I host it, you get all the money, I'll do all the publicity, you haven't got to do anything, and people would love it. Well, Ian, I've got no interest in doing it. And about 3 months later, he emailed me going, how would this work if we did do it? He said, he lived in Portishead. He said, I want to do it in Portishead. I want to be able to walk to the venue. What would it be like? And so I put on this show in the community hall in Portishead. And it was so lovely because the first half was him doing a talk. And the first 5-10 minutes, he was shitting himself. You could see it. And I'm at one side of the stage just in case he froze. And his lovely wife, Pat, was at the other side just in case he froze. 10 minutes into it, 5 minutes into it, he became that performer again. It clicked. Brilliant. And it kicked in, and he became that performer again. And it was such a lovely, lovely evening, because it was an evening full of love, people celebrating him, you know, listening to these wonderful stories. Mm. And it was delightful. Fast forward a few years, he died during COVID, heart problems and COVID. And when COVID ended, there was a lovely portrait done of him that was being unveiled at the Winter Gardens in Blackpool, I think it was. And we got invited. I got invited up. And Tommy Cannon came over to me and went, "All right, Ian, how's it going?" And we had a lovely chat, and they were making a statue of Bobby Ball. And he said, "I don't understand why we broke the records for the Winter Garden, and I don't know, there's not even a plaque. Mm. What have I got to do?" And I said, "Tom, you know what you've got to do. You have to die. You have to die before you get the recognition, because that's how we do it in this society, and it's nuts."
Yes.
Absolutely nuts.
And strangely enough, I do pursue those people, because I think that this is an opportunity to talk to them. I've spoken to a few.
Yeah,
Freddie Paraphase Davis.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I've spoken to Tommy on this. He was just lovely.
Yeah.
I am, this may be a secret, I may have to cut this out, but I am, for me, this is a beautiful thing, because I got put in touch with Anita Harris.
Oh.
By Freddie Davis.
Yeah.
He said, "You should talk to Anita. She's lovely. You'll love Anita. She's lovely." And I said, "I do love Anita."
Yeah.
And my father's favourite song was one of her hits.
Brilliant.
And she rang me up before Christmas and said, do you want to do this thing then?" I said, "I'd love to. Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Mostly because I want to tell you how much I love Loving You, the song Loving You." And I said, "It was my father's most favourite song."
Beautiful.
And she started singing it.
Oh, mate. And moments like that.
I cried on the... I said, "No, you'll have to stop. I'm crying. I can't listen to this." It was the most beautiful thing.
That's magic.
Mm.
I see it hitting you there. I can see it hitting you there. Look at that. Isn't that wonderful? Thank you for sharing that.
Ah, there we are.
There we go.
God, well, the Monkees, the fantastic Monkees. I am a believer.
There we go. Thank you. They're in. Where do we go? I realise I'm talking way too much. I tell you where we'll go next. The next thing I would like to put in the time capsule is...
Right, for anyone not subscribing to the Acast Plus version of this podcast, where you get it ad-free, here are some ads to help pay for the making of this adventure. Won't be long.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back. If you'd like to not have this podcast interrupted, then do have a look at Acast Plus. The link is in the description of this episode. For the rest of us, time to get back to the lovely Ian Lee. See you at the end.
The next thing I would like to put in the time capsule is radio.
Good.
Because radio has fed my kids and put a roof over my head for kind of 20 years, a bit longer actually. My first radio show was about 97 or 98. Mm. And I have enjoyed my journey through radio and discovering who I am as a presenter. And I like to think I got somewhere pretty unique. I've fallen out of love with it slightly, and that's why I brought it in, because I'd like to try and reignite my passion for it. I don't really listen very much because it's changed massively. And I'm a big fan of phone-in radio. And it's all very political now, and it's all very, we're going to point at these people and hate them, and that's what it's about. There's very little love. Mm-hmm. And I particularly like late night radio, 10 till 1 o'clock at night for me was always my favorite slot, because I think magic happens at that time. There's real magic. And it takes a special kind of person to phone up a radio station at 12:15 at night, 12:15. Mm. No one's doing that radio anymore, apart from a guy on BBC Manchester, a guy called Alan Bezick. He's the only person doing that, and he will be gone soon because of the changes. The only radio I really listen to now, Alan Bezick, bit of James O'Brien, and I listen to Capital, you know, because my kids get in the car, can we put Capital on? The first few times, like, Jesus, got to listen to this absolute crap. But I love it. I love it. Yeah. I love it. You know, I love the fact I'll be driving, and I like quite a lot of the music. Some of it I don't like, but I do like quite a lot of it. But being in the car with my two boys, and Kim, who's now 11, Kim on, sat next to me, singing along. And we have this gag. Now I go, did you write this one, Kim? He goes, yes, I did. And he just sings along to some songs that are quite rude in their lyrics, you know, really quite racy stuff. There's a song called WAP, W-A-P. Well, you've said the C word, so I can say this. What it means is, I can't look at you and say it. WAP stands for wet ass pussy. Imagine.
I think it was my nickname at school.
Oh, that's tickled my pickle now. Thank you. And so my 11-year-old singing along to a song called Wet Ass Pussy. I don't think they censor it for the radio, so ass and pussy won't be in there. But knowing that, and he's singing it at the top of his voice, and I'm thinking, this is the coolest and weirdest thing ever. And he's thrilled because these young presenters, some of these young presenters on Capital follow me on Twitter, you know. And when I tell him that, they're like, oh my God, that's so cool. That's sick. Oh my God, that's sick. OMG. They don't even say, oh my God. They go, OMG, that's sick. So I enjoy that. And I didn't think at nearly 50, that would be the main radio station that I listen to. And there's wonderful stuff happens on radio. I did a show a few years ago, a little tour called Ian Lee versus Radio. And I would play some of the bits where radio has gone wrong. And there are so many clips of people phoning up and saying rude stuff, and it, okay, well, we can't have that. We're going to cut you off. There's a lovely bit. There was a radio presenter, Anna Rayburn, who's the kind of the first ever, what you might call, she would hate this term, but it's a shorthand, agony aunt on mm-hmm. the radio. She dealt with people's problems. And I remember she worked at LBC with me. We didn't really get on, but that's okay. I still have respect for her. And she was doing a show about the history of words, where words come from. And someone texted in saying, oh God, what was the word? This isn't it. I can't remember it, but it was something like, oh, we have a lovely text here from Steve to talk about the word dick rubber. And he says the word dick rubber comes from sailors in the old day who, when they swore, would rub their dicks on a Bible. And she read it out straight-faced. And we're all brilliant. In the office going, oh my God, she's just said that, you know, and that was wonderful. And also, I never got caught out, but the people that would phone in with fake, rude names, and of course, the big one was Mike Pause Hunt. You say yes. Those words together, you got that. And I've heard that go out a few times. My favorite one, and then I'll be quiet, Nikki Campbell, who I love and I think is great, on a BBC Five Live breakfast show was talking, have you heard this clip? Was talking about the North Kent Hunt. He gets it wrong and he says the North C word and it's really embarrassing. He goes, okay, I'm really sorry, I apologize for that. And then an hour later he says, people are still talking about the North Cunt. Oh, I've done it again. That's on YouTube. I recommend people go and listen to
absolutely
that.
North brilliant.
Kent Hunt, Nikki Campbell. It's wonderful.
Oh my word. Years ago, see now you're too young to know this, but years ago I did a radio show for which was the forerunner of KYTV.
Radioactive.
That's right.
Yeah, oh, God, no, I'm not too young for that.
Oh, right, okay. Well, one of the characters on that we had occasionally was Mike Hunt.
Was it?
And we only put it in because we did it once and thought, we're going to get in trouble for this.
Yeah.
And nobody said a thing.
Oh, how wonderful.
So we did it again, and we kept doing it. And we did it over and over again until right at the end of, I think, Series 7, we were called in, and they said, one or two people have said that actually the way that you say that, it sounds... we went, what? Oh, no, but this is a long-running character. We can't change the name now. And they went, oh, OK, well, as long as you don't mean it, we got away with
as
it.
As long as you don't mean it!
As long as you don't mean it.
Oh, no, we don't mean it, sir.
You can say my cunt as long as you don't mean it. And we had another character played by Helen Atkinson-Wood who was a parody of Anna Rayburn.
Oh!
Which we called Anna Rabies.
Oh, my God, isn't that wonderful? It all links up. They were up until quite recently repeating those on BBC Four Extra.
Yeah, but, that's right. Yeah.
So you probably got a check for about 3 pence through.
Oh, almost that much. Yeah,
that was early 80s, wasn't it? I would imagine. Yeah. Mm. And quite often, comedy from late 70s, early 80s, it doesn't stand up because it's it's funny at the time, it doesn't stand up. I would say a lot of Radioactive still stands up. It's still very, very fast. There are bits you go, shit, did they just do that? And, you know, obviously the talent on it was incredible. You know, we talk about the 11 o'clock show and the talent that exploded, the talent that came from that show. Mm. And yeah, that a lot of that still stands up and is still very, very funny.
It's nice. We did a tour not long ago and we played Edinburgh. And because we're lazy bastards, we basically said we're going to do it as a retrospective. And we took sketches that we'd done on the radio and we put them together in a show.
Yeah.
And it went down a storm, and it was exactly the script.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting that you write a joke, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And that it's still funny. But because they were just silly, lots of them were just silly.
Yeah. It wasn't topical, and it wasn't necessarily of the time. And we need more silly. I miss silly, you know. Yeah. I'm a lot of my best radio shows were just nonsense, absolute nonsense, you know. And, I miss silly.
Yes, my favourite opening to any show was a phone-in. Interestingly enough,
right.
And said, OK, so we've got our first caller on the line. And the caller started by saying, OK, yeah, look, if I could just change the subject. He said, well, we haven't got one yet.
How daft.
And then the person said, oh, OK, well, I'll call back later then. And that was it.
Daft. And that very show, daft. You know, shows like that were the inspiration for things like the day to day, you know, or on the hour as it was on the radio. And then the day to day, you know, these, we're going to completely skewer what radio sounds like. We're going to get TV and we're going to really take the piss and use that format.
Yeah. I mean, well, for a long time, we thought maybe that was the case, but you don't really have the nerve to claim the somebody else's creative stuff. And then actually, rather sweetly, Steve Coogan and Patrick Marber both said that they were big fans of it when they were students and they took the idea and so they said it themselves.
How
and
he great.
Said, oh, how lovely.
And wonderful to acknowledge that because that doesn't happen very often in this business. It was my idea, nothing to do with you. I came up with it, you know. So, I think that show was integral.
Oh, well, that's nice. There we are. But there's so much about radio that is absolutely brilliant, and you're right to put it into the time capsule. And I've had a fantastic time on many things that I've done on radio, particularly at Capital Radio. I had some great times there.
Right.
There was a time when they used to do comedy shows.
And I don't remember that. Okay, yeah.
I'll send you some recordings.
Yeah, please do.
Yes, there's a thing called the Encyclopedia of Rock, which when you're talking about having cast members, I mean, that had Tim McInerney, Dawn French.
Incredible.
The cast list is ridiculous. And it was presented by my friend Jeremy, who I spoke about earlier.
Yeah.
Jeremy the Monkeys Pascal.
There we go.
And Angus Eden was the other presenter. But they did a brilliant thing where whenever anybody who was at all famous came into Capital Radio, they would nab them and say, could you say these lines? They would just record them and then they'd write a sketch around it.
How great. Oh, well, yeah, send me that if you've got any of those. I love stuff like that.
The trust of people doing things like that. I remember Elton John actually standing there saying, you want me to just say these words? They're just yes, no, I didn't. He said, you want me to record that? And what are you going to put between it? And they said, we'd just write some funny stuff around it. And he went, you could write anything, couldn't you? And they went, yeah, but, you know, we won't. He went, oh, who gives a fuck? And just did it.
See, a PR team surrounding a star would not let you do that. They wouldn't let you anywhere near them to do that. Brilliant.
No, are you a racist? Yes, I am. You know, it's easy to get them to say anything you like.
Michael, we'll talk about your politics in a minute. Let's carry on with the time capsule.
No, I like to bang on about it.
How brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And yes, well, we're lucky to have worked in radio, I think.
Oh, God, yeah. It's a privilege. What a privilege that, you know, I've done kind of pretty much every slot, that people will choose to fall asleep to me. And people say, oh, I don't think this is rude, I fall asleep to you. It's the greatest compliment you could ever pay to a late night phone-in host, you know, you fell asleep listening to me. Wow, you know, are you inviting me into your bedroom, into your car, into your bathroom, into wherever? You've invited me in. Thank you for that. Real privilege.
Real privilege, yes. The BBC foyer at Broadcasting House used to have a false jukebox in it, and in it you could press and listen to bloopers.
Oh.
I wonder if they've still got a recording of it somewhere.
That's wonderful.
They had the famous, the man who claimed he wasn't drunk, but who was talking about the lighting up of the fleet. Have you ever heard that recording?
I've not heard that one.
Just a very drunk, well, join me now as we're in for the fleet to, in a moment now to light up, and Oh, look at that. Isn't that lovely? Oh, my. Well, the fleet's all lit up. Oh, it's like fairy lights. It's such a funny...
I love it. One final one before we move on. My favourite one. The commercial radio has a 7-second delay. So if you phone up and swear, I can dump it, doesn't get broadcast. Yeah. BBC local radio doesn't, kids. Do with that information as you will. And there was a great... There was a phone-in on BBC London late at night. My friend James Max hosting it. And he says to caller, so what do you think about Boris Johnson then? Well, I think he's a cunt. And... That's on YouTube as well. Go and look for that.
There is the famous one, which I think is Pete Murray from way back.
Yeah.
It's the pause at the end of what he says that is the really funny thing about it. It's because he said, we've got a record here from Janet, who sadly, a husband of 55 years, Jack, dear Jack, has just passed away recently. She said, could you just play something to cheer me up? So I hope this does it for you, Janet. Here's Clodagh Rodgers with Jack in a Box. And then before the music starts, there's a moment where you can tell he's gone, oh, shit. And then he plays the music.
Love it. I love it. And live radio like that. How beautiful. How beautiful.
Beautiful thing. So let's treasure it and let's put it in there.
Where are we now? Are we number four?
We're on number four. So which one of your five are you going to reject?
This one I'm going to put in. Japan, I'm rejecting you. We'll come to you another day. I'm going to put in... ADHD, attention deficit hyperactive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Because I retrained a couple of years ago as a counsellor, diploma in counselling, and that's now what I do for a living. You know, it's my full time job. And on the course, I was nervous because at school I wasn't very good. I was not a particularly nice person at school, but I just couldn't sit still in a lesson. I couldn't listen. I couldn't learn. Average GCSEs, awful A levels. Just couldn't do it. I thought it was because, as some of the teachers told me, I was naughty and I was thick. That's what I was told. Imagine a teacher saying to a kid, well, you're naughty and you're thick. You know, you'll never amount to anything. That's what I had. And they may have been right on that. But on the course, a few months into it, one of the teachers, a lovely lady called Sally, went, well, of course, Ian, you're ADHD, aren't you? I said, no. She went, oh, maybe you should get tested for it. So I did. Some doctors will do it on the NHS, but it's like a 12-month waiting list, and I was impatient because I'm ADHD. So I got in touch with a psychiatrist, and you fill out a form and you answer some questions, and he came back and went, yeah, you are one of the most ADHD people I have ever met in my life. And it was... He diagnosed me as bipolar at the same time, and it was the most amazing thing. I ended the Zoom call, and I phoned up my friend and went, I'm ADHD. Because it was suddenly, it explained everything in my life, almost everything in my life. And I started reading a book about it. And I would keep phoning my friend and going, oh my God, the fact that I don't recognize faces. There are a few, you know, you've been on television a lot, so you're kind of locked in. But if I meet someone, I don't recognize a face. I don't remember names, cannot remember anybody's name. Thank God you've got it written on your Zoom screen because I would struggle. There was a weird one. Like we used to have this joke. If we were out and about having a meal, I could not hear what the person opposite was saying. I go, oh, there's too much hubbub. And we just thought that was a weird thing. That's part of being neurodiverse for some people. Our brains can't filter out noise like non-neurodiverse people. The fact that I take rejection so badly, you know, someone can say, no, I don't want to go to the pictures with you. And for days I'll be going, oh my God, they hate me. You know, sobbing about it. Relationship ended. You know, a relationship that hadn't lasted very long. I'd be devastated for months. So there are all these things that I just thought were normal, that everyone did. And it turns out not everyone does. And it's because my brain is wired differently. And it's brought me a lot of peace because I can now look back at school and go, I had no chance there. You know, it wasn't a thing then. People didn't recognize it.
No.
I had no chance in school because the way they taught, way schools teach, does not work for my brain. I have to watch something, write it down at the same time, and then highlight it. I need, you know, at least a three-tier system for it to go in, and it has to be visual for me for it to have an impact. You know, it's explained everything. It's also what has made my radio shows unique, because I remember I worked at BBC WM once, and there was a new boss, and my show started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and at 10 to two, I went down, and she said, "What's on the show today?" I said, "I don't know." She goes, "What's on that paper you've got? There's always a blank piece of paper to write down stuff." She said, and afterwards she said, "We'll talk afterwards." And she called me and she said, "You cannot go into a show without anything planned." And I said, "Was it a good show?" She went, "Yeah, no, today was a good show." I said, "Well, that's how I work. I cannot plan stuff." And it's given the fact that I can go off on 100 different tangents, as people may have heard today, that's what's made my radio shows the reason that a lot of people like them. It's also the reason a lot of people hate them, because there's not really a narrative.
Right, yeah.
So I would like to put ADHD in there, and I want to celebrate it. I think it's a wonderful thing once it's recognised, and I think it's a superpower, and I absolutely love the fact I got that diagnosis, because I can start being me.
And you're not a naughty boy and you're not thick.
No, no. It was like getting the instruction manual for life. It was like, oh, okay, right. Now I can apply this stuff and I can find ways of working around it. There is, I'm underneath my stairs. On the stairs is a packet of pills that I need to take upstairs. All I need to do, take them upstairs, put them in my bedside cabinet. They've been there for 3 weeks, because every time I walk past it, I go, "Oh, I'll do it next time." That's wonderful. I love that stuff. So ADHD and all neurodiversity, I want rammed up your time capsule, please, Mr. Fenton Stevens.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, I'm very happy to take that and to treasure it.
Yeah.
Because I have two autistic grandchildren.
Okay.
And one who suffers from PDA,
What's PDA?
PDA is pathological demand avoidance.
Okay.
So pathologically, she cannot cope with what appears to be somebody telling her what to do.
Incredible.
It sends her into complete panic. Her brain interprets, "Put your shoes on," as an attack.
Yeah.
And so she goes into either flight or fight mode. So you have to say, "I think it'd be a good idea to put shoes on sometime."
Wonderful.
"What do you think?" And she says, "I don't want to put them on." You go, "Okay, you don't have to put them on." And a minute later, she'll say, "I'm going to put my shoes on." You go, "Okay." It's incredibly difficult, as you can imagine. It makes life very difficult. She doesn't go to school. She can't cope with that system.
Yeah, of course.
As you say, school is not designed for people like that.
When I said wonderful, the wonderful was when you were describing the coping mechanism that I'm assuming it's her parents, but the family have developed and are developing to be able to integrate her into family and into society, you know, because there are some people that wouldn't do that. You know, it could get unpleasant and nasty.
Well, I'm sure in the past, people would have absolutely just seen her as a naughty child.
Yeah, do as you're told.
Yeah, make her do it.
I remember phone-ins on radio stations, late 90s, early 2000s. Is this ADHD a thing? It's just kids being naughty, isn't it? Because we didn't have the understanding.
No.
I would suggest that some schools are significantly better, and some schools, you know, they ain't got enough money, ain't got enough teachers, they've got to do all these tests that they have to do.
Yeah.
But some schools are learning to be accommodating to neurodiversity and different behaviours.
Yeah.
And also, the situation with your granddaughter, she's still a human being. She's still a wonderful, you know, life form. I bet you have so much fun with
her. Amazingly inventive. She's an incredible amount of fun. She's very, very funny. She's got a brilliant sense of humour.
Thank you for sharing that about your granddaughter, because I think it's important. You know, I'm celebrating mine because it really has a positive impact. Mm. It can, the different neurodiversities can be challenging for the family, but also the person. We do not live in a neurodiverse world. The person who is, and I like to say I am ADHD. I try not to say I have. I am. People use different phrases that works for them. That works for me. It can be so difficult for the person who is autistic, ADHD, whatever it may be. But we're all human beings, you know.
There are wonderful things to be found in all these things. As you say, you've found that for yourself. And for you, it's a real plus.
Yeah.
You've been given this superpower, you describe it as. Yeah. And now, I think that within all of them, if you search, if you give it the time, you will find those superpowers in people.
Give it the time. Mm. Yeah. You have to give it the time. And not everyone does. My last ever radio show, a couple of weeks ago, on my breakfast show I was doing, we'd had a caller. I wasn't there long, 6 months. A caller called Judy, who was dealing with cancer. And she also had an autistic son who couldn't speak, who chose not to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
The very, very last show, Judy phoned up saying, I just want to thank you for, doing the show. And also my son, I'm going to cry. my son wants a word. I'm thinking, what?
Oh, my God.
And he came on, he said, thank you, Ian Lee. And she said he hasn't spoken for however long, and that he spoke. That did me in. That's doing me in now. How beautiful. And that's down to her patience and love and encouragement.
Yeah.
Look, we're both getting a little misty.
It reminds me of, I knew a young lad. I did pantomime, and this young lad's mother wrote to me and said, could I bring my son back to meet you? He's autistic and he doesn't speak very much and he's never laughed.
Right.
And we came to see the pantomime and halfway through it, he became hysterical with laughter. And, the moment where you're sitting, putting your makeup on to do the 10 o'clock show and a pantomime, that's the thing that makes me go, oh, yeah, this is good.
Yeah. We don't know how our work has touched people. And I don't say that in an arrogant, egotistical way. Sometimes we're lucky enough. Sometimes I'll get an email or I'll be at a show and someone will come up and just say, that show you did on loneliness, that was me. And but we are so blessed in the career that I've had and your career that is still ongoing that we will be making a difference to people. You know, we talked about how a lot of this stuff isn't actually important. To some people, it is. And what a great story. He'd never laughed before. He laughed at your show. Mm. Wow.
I know. It's amazing. But, I mean, we're lucky that we have access to a lot of people. But I think that actually your attitude in life, as you say, you never know how you're affecting people. And I think that having the attitude of smiling at people, saying good morning to people, being patient with people, it can have an enormous effect. It's much easier to go, oh, get out of my way.
Yeah,
I've got important things to do. Just get out of my way, everyone,
because
I'm coming through. If you can actually teach yourself to go, well, hang on a minute, I'm not as important as I think I am.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would make a difference in the world.
I can also understand why people don't. I remember being young and thrusting and I am immortal. I will never die and I'm really, really important and I know everything. And I think perhaps it is a thing. Some people get it young, but I think it perhaps is a thing as you get older, as you cross over the halfway mark in this thing called life. I think that can be a changing point.
Yeah, that halfway point for me is coming soon.
Gosh, tell your face. How rude. Oh, how rude. Brilliant.
No, ADHD. That's you. You bloody ADHD people.
Exactly. Outrageous.
Saying outrageous things, honestly. Yeah.
Couldn't stop myself, Michael. That's my excuse. Couldn't stop it.
Well, I'm glad that you're proud of it, and I'm glad that you see it as a bonus and how lovely that you have it. And also that finally these things are being properly recognised.
We are getting there. We're a long way off, but we are definitely getting there, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic. You said you'd make me laugh and you said you'd make me cry, and you've done both, so...
Oh, that wasn't the one that was supposed to make you cry.
Well, oh, God, we're in trouble then. We'd better move on to it. I think that's what's coming, is it?
So this is the thing that I would kind of like to forget, and it's slightly... Okay, here's the thing I'd like to forget, and then we can talk about it. And this, I am going to cry. So it was just the past couple of weeks ago, it was the 10th anniversary of my dad dying. He died at 62, pancreatic cancer. And I did not speak to my dad for decades, for years. Did not speak to him. We fell out because he was not a great dad. He was, I suspect he was a sex addict and he was off having affairs. I don't know how many brothers and sisters I've got out there. I don't know. Mm. I know of three, four, five. I know of five. I think there's a sixth who might live in Australia. There may be more.
Wow.
Because he was out shagging all the time. You know, he was treating my mum terribly in that respect. I have a birth sister, my sister Jo, who I love wonderfully. And I've learnt to embrace certainly some of my half family, So because of that, he moved out when I was 14. I went, I'm never fucking talking to that prick again. And he would every now he would try to make contact. The thing I did as well is I said, I don't want to see that half of the family anymore. And my mum said, okay, I support that. And I look back and I think, I really wish my mum had said, okay, well, let's sit with that for 6 months and we'll talk about it when you've calmed. I was an angry young man. Mm. So I never saw Nanny Peg. I never saw Granddad Jock ever again. They died. Never saw them because I was an angry young man and I was not encouraged to reconsider that. And there would be moments where I make contact with my dad. I could never be myself around him. He wasn't violent. You know, you get smacked as you did in the 70s, which is not a good thing, but he was never violent. I just felt very intimidated by him and would could not really be myself. And there was some attempts at a reunion. I went and worked with him in Pakistan, bizarrely, on a film with Christopher Lee. He worked in TV. He was props manager at the BBC for a while. Mm. We went and worked in Pakistan for 3 months to try and get some reunion. It didn't really work. He told a massive lie while he was there. He was a compulsive liar, and he told this huge lie that my uncle had been in a serious car accident and was dying, and he had to go back and see him. It wasn't true. He was having a kid born. And, you know, that's wow. what we were dealing with. Mm. So I saw him very, very little. And one day I found, I'm in 12-step recovery. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And part of the 12-step recovery is making amends with people. And one day I found a watch and some pictures that I knew were important to him. So I got in touch after not speaking for years, saying, do you want to meet up and I'll hand this stuff over? And my plan was to go in and fucking lay into him. And I got there and suddenly I wasn't scared of him. Suddenly I wasn't intimidated. And I was able to say, these are the things that you did that had a negative impact on my life. And I want you to know they had a negative impact. I was also, Michael, able to recognize my part in it. You know, perhaps I could have reached out earlier to you, but, And at the end of it, I said, do you know what? I'm not prepared to call you dad yet, but if you're up for it, I'm interested in seeing if we can have a relationship. So we saw each other a couple of times. And very, very shortly after that, he got in touch and said, I've got pancreatic cancer and I'm going to die in 6 months. Mm. He said 2 years, but then I spoke to his wife and she said, I don't know where he's got that from, it's 6 months. Yeah. And I'm really grateful I made peace with him before I knew that. And suddenly this 6 months, and he got really ill very, very quickly. And I got to meet two of my half-sisters and a half-brother, got to meet his wife, who was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people, so generous to me, so kind. And he died really, really quickly, and it was a shit death. You know, it was a really shit, horrible, painful, morphined-up death. It was horrible. Mm. And another positive of that is I got to meet all my uncles and aunts again and my cousins because they would visit while I was there, and I was really scared, thinking, oh, my God, I've not seen them for, you know, however many years, this 15 years, this is going to be awful. Every single one of them, not one of them, criticized me or had a go at me or my sister. Every single one of them embraced me literally and metaphorically and invited me back into the family. Mm. I'm still reintegrating and I should be in contact more, but I find it very difficult. And then he died. And then his wife very kindly let me be a pallbearer at the funeral. Let me speak at the funeral. You know, I hadn't been in his life for years and Margaret let me speak at the funeral. And you know, I just think, fucking hell, what a fucking waste of time. Why couldn't we put whatever it was aside, talk through it, fight through it if we needed to? Why couldn't we do that and then get on with our lives of him as my dad, me as his son? Why couldn't we do that? And it is such a waste of time and such a waste of life. And so I make sure with my, you know, only my eldest met him. It was difficult. I knew my eldest met him when he would have been three and my youngest was a baby, but I didn't take my baby to meet him. And then when he got ill, I didn't really want him to see him like that.
No.
So only my youngest met him. He doesn't remember it. He was three. But I got one picture of him with Alex. And fucking hell, Michael, what a waste of life. What a waste of life. And we were talking earlier, and I don't know if it's in the podcast or if it was before, whatever, about living.
and about having to live and about, I don't want to be on my deathbed thinking, I wish I'd seen more of my kids. I wish I'd done that. So I don't live with my kids, but I'm very much a part of their life. Mm-hmm. They, you know, I didn't know where my dad lived. They know where I live. I see them every other week, every week. I'm going to go and see one of them in a concert tonight. You know, my ex-wife is incredibly open to that. You know, there's nothing, you know, she's wonderful about that. And I make sure I am there for my kids, whatever they want. I don't necessarily mean financial things. Mm. If they need me, if they phone me up, I make the time to speak to them. I listen to what they're interested in. They've got their own YouTube channels. I watch every single video they put up, you know, because I would hate, you know, I only recently am I realizing, shit, how difficult was it for him to not see his son and his daughter? How difficult was it for him?
Yeah.
You know. So the thing I want to put in there is the wasted life of not being with my dad.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there is always the thought in your mind that had you spoken to him the way you did eventually to begin with, he might have seen the harm in what he was doing.
Yeah.
And in a way, not changed, but controlled it a bit more.
I don't think he was well. You know, I think he was an alcoholic. I think he was a dry drunk. He used to drink when I was a kid, and then he stopped. And that reconciliation, I said, I was able to tell him, I'm an alcoholic and I'm a drug addict. And sorry, I'm sniffing a lot. And I'm curious as to why you stopped drinking. And he said, I was driving home drunk, and I hit a police motorbike, and I vowed I'm never going to drink ever again. And he stopped like that. But I do think he was still an addict in some way. And so his addiction came out in sex. He had to have something to change the way he felt. He had to have something happened to him as a kid. I have no idea what, but something happened to him as a kid that meant he had to do something to make him feel good. And for him, it was sex. Mm-hmm. I don't know why the kids were a part of it. You know, that's a mystery to me. I don't get what that is. But he wasn't well, and I can see it now. Yeah, he was a bastard to my mum, and I see that. And he was a shit dad, but he was doing the best he could with what he had.
Yeah.
And he didn't have a lot, but he did the best he could. And, you know, it's weird because it's one thing I can never change. One thing I can never change. And I've pretty much forgiven him. You know, I went and visited his grave last year, and I took some lunch, and I sat there, and I screamed at him, and I shouted at him, and I cried for him, and I, you know, and I asked for his forgiveness. And but that's with me forever. That's one thing that can't go. What a waste.
Yeah. There's a very strange phrase that people say a lot these days. I think it's a strange phrase. It's where they say, well, I need a little bit of me time. And I always think that we should all say to that, well, you're with you all the time.
I need less me time.
What you need is us time.
Yeah.
That's what you really need. Yeah. And I think that actually we're all led to believe that, you know, I just need to be with myself, just something for me, something that I want.
Yeah.
And actually, because of the nature of human beings, we spend most of the time thinking about what we want. And it would be a good thing to do it less, I think.
Yeah, I think, well, I know it's proven that doing things for other people makes us feel better. And for me, because of that upbringing, family is key. I got divorced, and that's not something I'm particularly proud of. But my partner now and my kids now and, you know, this is making me think I need to reach out to my dad's family because I've not spoken to them for a while, my aunts and uncles, and actually I'm going to get in touch with them this weekend because it is easy for me. Because I'm an addict, one of the things the disease of addiction is it likes to isolate us. If I'm isolated, then I'm stuck with my head. And if I'm stuck with my head, I probably wanted some beer. And if I get some beer, I'm going to want cocaine, you know. So it is a disease of isolation, and I struggle with reaching out to people. I struggle with company. So it becomes an effort. So if any of my family, particularly on my dad's side, are listening, I'm really sorry that I struggle to be in contact with you. I love you. I love you all. All my aunts and uncles and my cousins, actually, I really, really love you. I find it so difficult to reach out. And that's something I need to do and I will do.
Mm. Yeah, because you're right. It is a waste of life to not take the opportunity. It's there.
Yeah.
It's never going to be all of your life. You think, oh, I haven't got the time. I've got so many things to do.
I've got to work. Fuck that.
Why don't they just let me have a little bit more me time and then I'll be okay. But actually, you know, if you really offer people me time, in the end they go, well, where's everybody gone?
Yeah.
So the best thing, I think, is, as you say, to try and find out why these things are happening. And also for your own benefit, like you say, forgive yourself and forgive them.
Yeah. When my kids come and stay with me, I try and put the phone away. I'm present for them. I am there for them. And what's great is they're 13 and 11. And, you know, sometimes they'll be coming for the weekend and I'll get to think, oh, Alex is doing something with his friends. But he doesn't have to do it. He can come with you. Huh. And part of being a parent is being able to let them go and go, no. I'm not going to go, this is my weekend. Let him go and do what he wants to do. And it's really sad because my babies are now young men and I miss the babies and I want to spend time with them. But also being a good parent is recognizing when they are ready to go off and do their own stuff and don't necessarily want to be with you.
Yeah.
And it's tough. It's weird. It's beautiful and it's tough simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Means we're doing a good job.
But OMG, it's sick.
Another thing they'd say, lollers. That means it's funny. Lollers. You're so poggers, Michael. Yeah. So
Ian, well, how lovely. Thank you so much for taking such care in thinking about these things and for telling us the things you've told us. I think it's I'm really honored. Thank you.
That's a great rehearsal. Should we do it for real?
Have you started recording yet?
I haven't. I'll click record in a minute.
Okay, great. Yeah, don't do any of that cunt swear stuff thing. Don't do that.
So you can't say cunt, fuck, what's shit any
shit,
good?
Shit, bollocks.
Wanker.
Talent. Can't use any of those words.
not in reference to me. Thank you for the opportunity. Listen, I've only listened to a few of your podcasts, but I'm now subscribed and I'm diving through it. And I really, really appreciate this opportunity, Michael. Thank you so much and keep up the good work.
Lovely. It's nice to meet you again.
Yeah, yes. I'll see you in another 25 years.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Ian Lee. I know we went on a bit, but I just found him a fascinating man to talk to, so I hope you enjoyed it too. If you did and want others to know that, then please do rate the show and feel free to leave a comment or even a review. We really appreciate the effort. Thanks. And if you want to hear more, then do subscribe to this podcast. You can also follow me and My Time Capsule on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and any one of them is the best way to message us, as we always have our noses in our phones, obviously. Alternatively, you can entertain yourself by listening to the theme tune by Pass the Peas Music on Spotify and trying to work out how many beats there are in a bar and when the little stabs come in. I bet you can't do it. This was a Cast-Off production for Acast, produced by John Fenton Stevens. Right, I better go before the pills wear off. I'll leave you with a bit of magic for a change. Okay, I want everyone to think of a number between 1 and 10. Got it? Okay, now concentrate on it very hard and try and telepathically send me that number. Yeah, I think it's coming through. Okay, your number is 7. Amazing, isn't it? At least 10% of you went, bloody hell, he's right. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.